Vader, nadiku merba u inħosni verament gburi u ferħan li għat maħkom il-lejla unek. U sanibda billi inkanta kanzunetta fuq klim tal-poeta Oliver Frigiri, jisima Ekbis ikun poeta.
Mehaba bikom. I told Jimmy he's got to find something different for tomorrow night as well. It's always very dangerous, you know, when you try and say something in another language. I remember when I first went to the Philippines and I had to meet the faculty of our university there, 1,000 professors. And I said, what shall I say? And they said, say mabuhay, which means greetings. But I was so jet-lagged, I said, Mabahu. which means this is a smelly place. Last night I talked about how we can try to reach the young, and that means that we must recognize them, we must learn to see them, we must see what are their values, which must be respected, welcomed, and stretched open, challenged. And we looked principally at happiness and suggested that in Christ we find a happiness which is large enough for sorrow. We looked at freedom, and we found a freedom which is big enough to include giving your life away. And we looked at truth, truthfulness, authenticity, which has to be vast enough for the truth of the other person. And so tonight, I want to take and explore a bit more deeply this theme of freedom. And the reason I wish to do so is because the surveys conducted by the European Union show consistently every time that this is the value which is most cherished by the young. It's also believed to be a value which is not respected by the church. The church is often seen as being against freedom. And so if we are going to share our faith, it's extremely important that we try to address in a bit more depth what it means to be free as Christians. One year I went on a visitation of the Czech province of the Dominican Order. And most nights you have meetings with the Dominican family. I remember at a little place called Šnumoj. We sat around, we ate beautiful sausages, drank wonderful Czech beer, and filled with young families. And there was a young woman there, a young mother of three. And she said, "Timothy, I have a question." She said, "How do I pass on the teaching of the church to my children? Because they resist it. They won't accept it." And I was a bit puzzled as how to answer this, so I did what is always a good move. I passed it to the person who was my assistant. And he was the, what we call the socius for Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, a big Pole, like a bear, called Wojciech Giertych, who was professor of moral theology at the Angelicum. Now listen very carefully to his answer. Wojciech isn't just any old nutty theologian. Wojciech is a man who was named last year to be the official theologian of the Pope, what we call the master of the sacred palace, which is nearly always a Dominican, in fact, always a Dominican. Shows there is something good in this church, you see. It's nice to see one's collaborators do well. I hear there are rumors, my brother John Sherry, that you're going to be the next prefect of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. Anyway, Wojciech got up and he went to the blackboard and he drew a small square on the board. And he wrote, "In that square are the commandments. Is that what morality is about?" And everybody said, "Yes." And he said, "No." And he drew a much bigger square, including it. And he said, "All this is freedom. That's what God is interested in." He said, "God isn't very interested in the commandments." St. Paul says, "For freedom, Christ has set us free." And, even more important, obviously, for a Dominican, St. Thomas Aquinas says, "The whole of the moral life is the entry into the freedom and the happiness of God." So when people look at us, they should be astonished by our freedom. But that isn't always the case. Very often, I'm afraid, the church comes over as timid, cautious, hesitant, afraid. Do you remember in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, the Grand Inquisitor says, "In the end, they will lay down their freedom at our feet and say, 'Make us slaves, but free us.'" So if we're going to be preachers of the gospel, then we must claim the freedom that is ours in Jesus Christ. In that book, What's the Point of Being a Christian?, which I hear you've ordered from the United States, although all the books actually went from England to the United States, they can come back again. In my book, I explore this by looking at the story of the Last Supper, which is the story of the Exodus, Israel's entry into freedom from slavery. This evening, I thought to take a different topic, to take the raising of Lazarus. And the reason for that is twofold. First of all, because if you bought the book, you might feel cheated. So it was good to take a slightly different angle. Well, I see a copy there. And secondly, because it is the raising of Lazarus that in John's Gospel precipitates the crisis that we enter into on Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter Sunday. So the raising of Lazarus is a very good way to prepare ourselves for the next phase of Holy Week. I want to look at this story. I want to look at three phrases in the story and suggest how they introduce us into progressively deeper understandings of freedom. The first phrase is, "Lazarus, come out." The second phrase is, "Unbind him and let him go." And the third phrase is how Jesus has to face those who say, "It is expedient that he should die." And each of these will suggest a slightly deeper freedom. So Jesus commands them to roll away the stone, and he says, "Lazarus, come out." At this first level of freedom, we see freedom as the power to stand on your own two feet and walk. That's a wonderful image of freedom. In our society, we usually see moral decisions. This is a bit of a oversimplification, but forgive it. In terms of either you decide what you want to do, what's right for me, or else some people see it in terms of submission to the rules of the church. So if you take sexuality, some people think of it as a lifestyle option, what feels right for me, purely subjective. Other people see it as submission to the rules of the church, submission to an external authority, to what is purely external and objective. What this gospel text does is it summons us beyond that dichotomy, that opposition, because we see that freedom, that morality, if you want, is about obedience. But it's an obedience to a voice that says, "Stand on your own two feet and walk." Obedience for a Christian, we always locate its original meaning in ob audiens, to listen. So obedience is fundamentally obedience to the voice of God who sets us free. So it's not an infantile submission. St. Thomas Aquinas, we have to get him in soon. St. Thomas Aquinas said, "We are made in the image and likeness of God insofar as we are the sources of our own acts, having freedom of choice and power over our deeds." I think that that's wonderful. We are made in God's image by being the source of our own deeds. So a properly human act, a moral act, isn't an act that you do under external constraint. You know, there's a law which says be nice to Jesuits, and therefore you have to be, you know. A moral human act is one that you perform from the very center of your being, that is fully your act, which you perform, according to Thomas Aquinas, single-heartedly. You act from the core of your being, because that's where God is. So an act that is entirely mine, that springs from who I most deeply am, is simultaneously an act that is utterly graced of God. That's maybe a difficult one to get one's head around, but I hope it'll become clear as we go on. So learning to walk is a wonderful symbol of how we learn to enter into our freedom. I remember about 20 years ago, I had a terrible operation on my back, and I was immobilized for about 6 months, entirely flat, utterly at the whim of my brethren. I couldn't even go down and choose my own food, and one day I couldn't take it any longer. So I got up and I hobbled downstairs to get my own breakfast. And when I had to go back to my bedroom on the second floor, I was faced with the first step and I couldn't climb it. I couldn't put even one foot on the step. And I had to sit down and wait for somebody to help me back to my room. And in fact, there was an Italian Dominican I'd never met. He wondered who I was, but he helped me up to my room. And afterwards, he said he was surprised to meet one of the brethren who at 10 o'clock in the morning was so drunk that he couldn't get back to his room. There was a chap called Stephen Vaught. I don't know whether you read about him. A few months ago, he walked from one side of America to the other. He did this because he weighed over 20 stone, and he had to lose weight, as you can imagine. And as he walked, he discovered that it was far more than just a question of losing weight. For him, that walking was a symbol of taking his life in his own hands, or on his own legs, you might say. He said to the BBC, "Most people see themselves in what I'm doing. They wish they could do something similar to get over their own personal plateau, whether it's overeating, smoking, or just finding a way to live a better life. I'm not trying to be a hero or an icon to anyone. I'm just an ordinary guy trying to take control of my life and figure where it went wrong." One of the ways that we do this, one of the ways we learn to walk on our own legs, is by learning to think about moral decisions. It's not good enough, and it's totally contrary to the whole tradition of the Roman Catholic Church, to think that we should just passively wait for documents to float in from Rome telling us what we should do. We have to form people to be moral by teaching them how to be attentive, how to listen to the Gospels, how to study the teaching of the Church, how to think and wrestle with moral issues, and how to be attentive to God in their experience. One of the ways the Church is the crucible of mature Christian freedom then is by teaching us to use our minds. Cardinal Newman said that there are three authorities in the Church. There is the authority of tradition, which is in the safeguard of the hierarchy. There is the authority of reason, which is largely the responsibility of the universities. And there is the authority of experience, which is entrusted to the whole people of God. And Cardinal Newman said, if one of these models absolutely dominates, things go wrong. If tradition dominates totally, then you're likely to fall into tyranny. If reason dominates totally, you're likely to fall into dry rationalism. If experience becomes the only real authority, then you'll fall into superstition. So this university has an important role in cultivating people who are able to think about moral issues and so claim their true Christian freedom. Makes me think of one of my brethren who's called Herbert McCabe. He was perhaps one of the greatest moral theologians of the 20th century. And when Herbert was 6 years old, a little bit older than our dear baby back there, when Herbert was 6 years old, it is said that his mother said to him one day, "John," that was his baptismal name, "John, you've been very, very naughty. You have been so bad that it may even be a mortal sin." And little Herbert said, "Mother, your reasoning is faulty." According to the teaching of the church, I do not have the rational capacity to commit a mortal sin until I am 8 years old. So we form people for the journey, the way, the pilgrimage to heaven. As you know, the earliest name for Christianity was the Way. We are walkers. We walk in the way which leads to God. And when we teach people to walk, they have to start from where they are. People start from all sorts of odd situations, what we call irregular situations. Divorced, remarried, gay, whatever. But wherever they are, that's where they start. We mustn't be like that man in Ireland who, when somebody asked him, "How do I get to Dublin?" he said, "If I wanted to go to Dublin, I wouldn't start here." It's wherever people are that the journey begins. For Lazarus, it was a tomb. For Bartimaeus, it was being a blind beggar by the way. For Peter, it was fishing on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. It's where you are that you start. And it's who you are that is called. Of course, we need rules and regulations. We need the Ten Commandments. They are necessary. They were given not as an external constraint. They were given to Israel so that she might grow in friendship with God. Law in the Bible is always given in the context of friendship. The Ten Commandments are given so that we may learn what we most deeply desire and who we most deeply are. Herbert McCabe said, "All ethics is about learning what you want," which is to say, becoming free. So if in a mad, wild moment you suddenly felt the desire to kill Jimmy, and then you remembered, "Thou shalt not kill," it's not that you would be saying, I hope, "Well, I really want to kill him, but regretfully I'm not allowed to." You would be reminded that actually, in the deepest part of your heart, you don't want to. Because he is your brother. If you were to kill him, you would regret it. Because you would probably go to prison. But much more profoundly, you would have remorse. Remorse isn't the same as regret. Regret is being sorry afterwards that you did something. Remorse is knowing that you didn't really want to do it at the time. So we need the Ten Commandments. We need that moral tradition of the church to educate our hearts and our minds, to put us in touch with our most profound desires and our most deep identity. It's rather like learning to play the saxophone. If you want to learn to play the saxophone, you will have to spend a lot of boring time playing scales. If you really learn the discipline of playing the scales, then you will be able to improvise beautifully. The moral discipline of the church should teach us spontaneity so that we are able to do what we most deeply desire freely. It's the spontaneity of Jesus. Think of how Jesus, he walking along, he sees the disciples by the seashore, and he calls them. It's a completely spontaneous act. He didn't have something in his diary saying, I better call a few disciples today. I'll look out for some plausible candidates. He sees Zacchaeus up the tree, and immediately he says, come down, I'll eat with you tonight. He sees the rich young man, and he loves him straight away. What you see in Jesus is the utter spontaneity of somebody who is completely in tune with his Father, whose obedience sets him free. I don't know whether you've ever come across a man called Donald Nicol, wonderful man who used to be the head of Tantur, the Ecumenical Institute in Jerusalem. One day Donald was out jogging in the heat of the sun. And as he went around a corner, he passed a group of Muslim workers. And one of them cried out, you must be thirsty. And he immediately gave him a bunch of grapes. And Donald said, here you see somewhere, here you see that deep spontaneity characteristic of holy people who do not simply react superficially, but respond immediately from the depths of their being, from their heart. Because that's where God is. When I read that passage from Donald's book, I realized that very morning I had done exactly the opposite. I'd been sitting in church, trying to get a quiet time of meditation before Mass, and a little chap called Eddie came in. Eddie was very, very dirty. And from his very, very dirty coat, he took an extremely dirty digestive biscuit. And he tried to put it in my mouth. And I said, no, thank you. Thank you, Eddie. I'm saying my prayers. And then he went to my Dominican sister about 6 feet away, and she accepted it gracefully. She'd acted with true Christian spontaneity. I had reacted superficially with irritation. And every day I used to long when Eddie came in that he'd give me another chance. But he didn't. And now Eddie is with the angels, probably absolutely immaculately clean, and offering them all his digestive biscuits. So that's the first layer of freedom that I want to look at. It's entering into Christ's spontaneity. The dead man came out, his hands and his feet bound with bandages, and his face wrapped in a cloth. And Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. This text has always puzzled me. If his legs and hands were bound, how did he get out of the tomb? Now, Raymond Brown is the greatest scholar on St. John's Gospel of the 20th century. So I looked it up, and he said, anybody who poses that question is clearly stupid. But I would like to reserve judgment about that. I think the point is, that to become free, you need the help of your friends. The first image of freedom that I gave you, walking on your own two legs, can look a bit too much like freedom as autonomy. Freedom as being a rugged individual. Freedom as being sort of John Wayne figure. And this has to be complemented with another image of freedom, which is a freedom which your friends give you. You see, Lazarus isn't only freed from the tomb, he's freed into the company of his friends. He's returned to those who love him. Freedom is not only freedom from constraint, it's also always freedom for others. Freedom to belong. In fact, sometimes we help people to be free precisely by showing that we, them and we ourselves, are not rugged individuals. That we are weak and that we need to help each other into freedom. There's a story told of a 4th century desert father called Macarius. Macarius was a famous holy man living in the desert. And one day, another famous holy man came to see him. I forget his name, but we'll call him Fred. And Fred had such a reputation for holiness that everybody was terrified of going to confession to him. He was severe. And Macarius looked at him and he said, "Fred," he said, "can I ask you a rather personal question?" Well, I don't know how you translate that from the Greek, from the Egyptian, but he said, "do you ever have problems with your sexual fantasies?" Typical opening conversation on Gambit, you know, in the Desert Fathers. And Fred said, "oh no, I'm beyond all that." Macarius said, "oh, although I have been an ascetic and I have lived in the desert for 40 years, and many people sing my praises, yet I do sometimes still have sexual fantasies." And Fred said, "oh, I see. Well, perhaps sometimes, you know." And then slowly Macarius confessed his own weaknesses and helped Fred to face his identical failings. And sometimes in the church, I think if we are to help people to be free, we have to admit the fact that we're also bound. If we want to help people to be strong, we have to face the fact that we are weak. I sometimes think that in the church, we would speak with far more authority if we obviously spoke as weak people and not as people who appear to be absolutely impeccable. But Martha isn't only worried, Martha isn't very enthusiastic about Lazarus leaving the tomb. She says, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Now, it's not just that she's worried about a bad smell. Dead bodies are ritually impure, particularly after the 3rd day. If you got near a corpse, it would render you unfit to share the life of God. High priests never were allowed to touch a corpse, not even of their family. So what Martha seems to be saying at this point is she's terrified of being polluted. She doesn't want to belong to her dead brother. And it's interesting, the text says the dead man walked. Dead man walking. So if the church is to be a crucible of freedom, Christ's freedom, then we have to share Christ's freedom to belong to anyone. Christ had the freedom keep company with prostitutes and tax collectors and lawyers and Pharisees and Roman centurions. He wasn't afraid to be the friend of anybody. He had an indiscriminate friendship as vast as God. In England, if you receive the freedom of a city, then it means that you belong. If we receive the freedom of the city, of the heavenly city, that means we must be prepared to belong with anyone. All of Jesus' friends. So the question I'd like to put to you is, who are you afraid of being associated with? Who would you rather not be seen to have friendship with? Who are the people you would like to keep at a distance? Because as long as there's anybody, then we haven't fully entered the freedom of Christ. One example very often in our society is people who are HIV positive or who have AIDS. They're often seen as the lepers. You know, the people you want to keep rather far away from. Polluting. If the church is to be a sign of the freedom of Christ, then it has to be because we are seen to be a community which accepts people with AIDS and the center, at the heart of the community, as Christ did, or would have done, or does. I was in Zimbabwe just a year ago, and one of the things that most moved me and touched me in Zimbabwe is to see how the church is at the forefront of welcoming people with AIDS, who are often despised. I went to a place run by the church called Mashambanzu, which, as you probably know, is the Shona for the time that the elephants wash. I don't know about here in Malta, but in Zimbabwe, elephants wash at dawn. They go down to the river, they splash around, they play, they frolic. So Mashambanzu, the time when the elephants wash, is a symbol of a time of hope and joy. And for me, it was really beautiful to go to Mashambanzu and to meet all these people laughing with joy, with hope, as they faced their own death and at the heart of the church, which is where they should be. So this is the question I leave with you. Who are you afraid of being associated with? People from Gozo? Yesterday, at a previous lecture, I have to confess, yesterday I met the Bishop of Gozo. But when he introduced himself, I thought he said the Bishop of Kosovo. But I think he must have been very surprised when I said, I pray for your people often for the terrible sufferings. But he was very nice about it. Is it Protestants? English people? So what I'm suggesting is that Lazarus symbolizes in these first two phases a beautiful tension between freedom as the power to walk on your own two legs, but freedom is something that you need your friends to help you with. As the Beatles used to sing, you remember, you get by with a little bit of help from your friends. The freedom to belong. And then we get to the final level of freedom, which you will be glad to hear treat more briefly. It is expedient that one person should die. This is Jesus' deepest freedom, is that he goes to the tomb to summon his friend to life, although he knows that it will lead to his death. He does it because it is right. When the chief priests and the Pharisees hear of the raising of Lazarus, they say, What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on thus, everybody will believe in him, or the Romans will come and destroy both our holy place and our nation. And one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. Do you not understand? It is expedient that one should die for the people." Expedient. Faced between the clash of the Roman power and Jesus, they opt for what is expedient because they think they have no option. How often have we not appealed to expediency to do what is quite simply wrong? At the beginning of the Second World War, it was universally accepted that you could never kill innocent civilians. But by the end of the war, we were doing things like blanket bombing Dresden, killing more than 100,000 innocent people in a night, because it was expedient. We dropped bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Hundreds of thousands of people burnt up because it was expedient. And there's Guantanamo Bay, where people are kept without any legal protection because it is expedient. And many European countries, including my own, to my shame, collaborate in what the Americans called special renditions, which mean the people can be taken away to remote places to be tortured, because it is expedient. Expediency is a profound loss of freedom. It implies that regretfully, sorrowfully, I cannot do anything else. Mrs. Thatcher's nickname, you remember, was Tina. There is no alternative. You remember that famous phrase in the Vietnamese War? We had no choice. We had no choice but to destroy the village, to save it from the communists. So the end justifies the means. You can do something bad, you say, because, well, it'll serve the final good. And in our culture of control, the more we labor to control, the more we lose control, and so the more and more things we find expedient. But Jesus embodies an utter and beautiful freedom, which is the freedom to do what is right, for no other reason than that it is right and good, whatever the consequences. Now, because now is the only moment that exists. Martha says to him, Jesus asks Martha whether she believes in the resurrection. She says, "Oh, I know he will rise again on the last day." But Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life." Now. Now is the only moment you've got to be free. On the 23rd of March in 1980, just before he died, Archbishop Oscar Romero preached a beautiful sermon on the woman taken in adultery. It was a sermon about freedom. A beautiful, extraordinary sermon. I printed it out to prepare this lecture. 23 pages long. If you think Jimmy ever preaches too long, just be grateful you didn't have Oscar Romero. And he concludes this incredible sermon with an appeal to the soldiers who were all around the square listening to him on this penultimate day of his life. He said, "Brothers, you are of our same people, and you kill your own peasant brothers and sisters, but over an order to kill given by a man, or to prevail the law of God, which says, 'Do not kill.' Now is the time to reclaim your conscience and obey your conscience rather than the order of sin." You see in that statement all the three layers. being a moral agent, stand on your own feet. Freedom is the freedom to belong. Belong with your brothers and sisters, the campesinos. And freedom is the freedom to do what is right, regardless of the consequences. Have you ever seen a film called Tsotsi? Oh, you should. Tsotsi, you've seen it. Tsotsi is a film about a South African gangster, a kid. His name means thug, and that's what he is. He's a murderer and he's a robber. And one day he robs a car from a wealthy woman and drives away, shoots her, cripples her, and drives away. And when he gets back to Soweto, the township outside Johannesburg, he finds the kid on the back seat, the baby. And this is the moment when he has to really make the most important decision of his life. Because he comes to love the kid. He is softened. And then he realizes that if he loves that kid, he must give the child back to his parents. Although this will mean his imprisonment and surely also his death. So you have this incredibly moving scene where he comes up to the house and he brings the baby to give it back to the parents. And the police and the army are all around surrounding him. And trembling, weeping, he hands over the baby. And then he's free. Although he'll be imprisoned, he was free to do what is right. I must say, I was so moved. I wept. Well, actually, I even wept during the adverts, I have to confess. But I was so moved and wept so much that the friend I went with said that she would never, ever go to the cinema with me again. For most of us, to claim our freedom will not be so dramatic as this, as with Oscar Romero or Tsotsi. But it might be in saying what we truly believe, even if this affects our job promotion, even if it affects our reputation, even if it means that we are badly seen. Because, as Oscar Romero said in that last sermon, he said, God is the only protagonist of human history. Expedient acts will never bring us closer to the kingdom. So, to conclude, almost, we see these three levels of freedom: to stand on your own feet and be a moral agent, to dare to belong to others and help each other into the freedom of God's eternal love, and the freedom to do what is right, whatever the consequences. But we get one last little glimpse of Lazarus and Mary and Martha before the end. They're having a party. Maybe they're having a party to celebrate that Lazarus has returned from the dead. And we too, perhaps our ultimate liberation is into festivity, into laughter. Joseph Pieper says, grace frees us to laugh with a freedom that creates freedom in others. St. Dominic's immediate successor was a wonderful man called Blessed Jordan of Saxony. And one day he went to visit the novices, and they were all giggling in church, as is the wont of novices. And one of the senior brethren looked at them and said, stop laughing, you're not allowed to laugh in church. And Blessed Jordan said, please, laugh to your heart's content, and don't stop on his account. You have my full permission to laugh as much as you want, because you've been freed from the chains of the devil. And presumably they stopped giggling immediately. Just 30 seconds to be quiet, and then share any questions, any reactions, any experiences, and anything that you want. Should we just take a little bit of a moment to... So,
when you mentioned someone who would try to be a moral agent, to be virtuous, and to be truly happy in that virtuous life, my question is, how does such a person deal with moments of feeling smug and self-righteous and saying, what a good person I am, when it tips the balance, you know, when it stops being just about being good? Thank you.
That's very interesting. I suppose that one of the signs of that spontaneity is what you might call a lack of self-consciousness. When you're really spontaneous, you don't think of yourself as doing it. You just do it. For example, my parents were both brilliant dancers, but I danced like an elephant. When I used to go to Africa, you know that almost any occasion in Africa, the moment comes when everybody takes to the floor and they dance. And I used to dread it. So I go plonking around. I remember once arriving in the north of Nigeria, and the local bishop, who was a Dominican, turned up, and he grabbed me, and he said, come, Timothy, dance with me. And I thought, oh, my God. 100 Dominicans watching me, you know. And that's because when I try to dance, I look at myself dancing. One may look at oneself doing something well, smugly, or you may look at yourself, as I did on that occasion, with shame. But I think the really virtuous person does almost unselfconsciously what is right, without saying, I'm a pretty brilliant, virtuous person, aren't I? Imagine if you were a tennis player, if every time you were about to do a shot, you looked around the grandstand of Wimbledon and said, look, aren't I doing a wonderful shot? You'd miss the ball. So I think Aquinas says something very interesting. He says, often people think that the harder it is to do an act, the more virtuous it is. So it would not be difficult for me to give up tea, since I can't abide it, but it would be much harder for me to give up coffee, because I love it. But Aquinas says the more virtuous you become, the easier it becomes, because the more it becomes second nature. And so you enter into the ease of doing it without watching yourself in the mirror. Don't forget, no such thing as a stupid question, only stupid answers.
You know how the scope, yesterday we spoke about reaching out to younger people. It is all very good for us because probably all of us are convinced of Jesus Christ. What if you are trying to reach out to a young person and you speak of this freedom that Jesus gives you and he tells you, but I can't believe in Jesus. How do you start telling him about Jesus, how to believe in Jesus? That do you just tell him, pray that you might have faith?
I hope that one thing is that he might see our freedom. I've had the easy task. I've talked about it. Now you've got to go and live it. And that's a much more difficult task. So I think people have to be able to see that freedom in us and ask, what's the secret? Like in happiness, there's an example which moves me. Charles de Foucault, a very ascetical man who lived in the desert in Algeria. And he went back to Paris and met one of his young cousins. And his cousin lived a riotously good life. He thought he was really having a wild time. You couldn't be happier than him. Lots of money and all the pleasures of Paris. And the cousin said, I looked at my cousin Charles de Foucault and I saw that he had a happiness that I had only ever guessed. So I think what's important is that people see. It's very interesting. They say that Jesus taught with authority, more authority than the scribes and the Pharisees. So what was Jesus' authority? And I think part of it was his evident freedom. That he went up and embraced the untouchable people. That he went up, that he had this joy. And sometimes this anger too. So the people could see in his life where was that authority. Now we can't have that same authority because we're not Jesus. Always part of the difficulty about bearing witness to Christ is that we are ourselves bound and often imperfect people who cannot speak with that same authority of Jesus. But if people see a little bit of it, if they see just a glimpse that we're not always looking over our shoulder and thinking, I wonder if anybody's going to report me and am I allowed to say this? And if they see something of that freedom, which is the freedom of the saints, then they'll believe. And I don't know about you, but in my experience, most young people actually are very keen on Jesus. Their difficulty is they're not so keen on the church. And I think we have to show them that believing in the church and with the church is actually a part of entering the freedom and the joy of Christ, because it is always the community of his body. Ultimately, belief isn't my beautiful private relationship with Jesus. My belief is belonging to the people of God.
I would like to touch on the point you mentioned about freedom and communicating the commandments with young people. You depicted it very well with the small box, the small square you mentioned in the beginning. My question is this, how do we communicate to our young generation the idea of freedom? And at the same time, when we have a Roman Catholic Church, particularly in Malta, which I would dare say is pretty much of a staunch Catholic Church in the sense that we're really, you know, perhaps the messages we keep getting from our young people is that it's our church is pretty much like traffic signs, I would say, you know, no entry, no left turn, no parking, no, it's always advocating what we should not do. Now, at the same time, how can we be preaching this freedom, which we talk so much gladly about? I mean, it's very difficult to strike the right balance. I mean, how do we go about that? I mean, that's my question.
I think one step forward, which I may have mentioned yesterday, I can't remember, is in many parts of the church, there is the recovery of the idea of moral formation as training in virtue. This was what Aquinas taught. This was the main way that you taught virtue in the Middle Ages, really right up to the Reformation. Well, I'm not a historian. I may well be wrong. Forgive me if that's not absolutely accurate. But teaching morality in terms of virtue is a wonderful way, I think. And all over the world, people are rediscovering it. Because the virtues are the virtues that form you as a pilgrim. Courage, prudence. Prudence isn't being cautious. Prudence is living in the real world. Temperance and justice. So what the fundamental, the cardinal virtues do is they teach you to be someone who's able to take decisions, somebody who's morally mature. And then the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, which are already our sharing in the end of the journey, our sharing in the life of God even now. And I think young people would respond much more sympathetically to that sort of moral, that moral vision in terms of the virtues. Interestingly, Augustine says, if you want to learn the virtues, learn the Beatitudes. It's only in England we can see, I don't know about where you were saved, the Reformation year, but in England you see, whenever you see the Ten Commandments being stuck on the walls of the churches, that's a sign that the Reformation has happened. It's a shift of moral model. It's a shift you find inside the Catholic Church too, unfortunately. But what you find fascinatingly now is that in America and Britain, and beginning now in France, all sorts of secular moral philosophers are saying, this is really interesting. They're studying Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas. So I think that's one way to do it.
I'm struggling a little bit with what you said about moral freedom, about freedom to do the right thing for its own sake. I'm not struggling with the idea. That's not the problem. The problem is that the freedom to do the right thing for its own sake is often constrained by our duty to others. And for me to do the right thing in the circumstances that face me can often, in the way the world turns, impose unacceptable consequences on others for whom I am responsible. I therefore am constrained to compromise. So much am I constrained to compromise that very often I don't have a choice between right and wrong. I have to choose between the best degrees of wrong that I can discern. And I find my whole moral life then compromised. How does Christ help me in this?
Perhaps you could give me even a little example of this. I can roughly see, but it might...
You mentioned someone at work, for example, standing up for the right thing, even if it costs promotion or it costs you your job. Now, someone with a wife and children to support and a mortgage to pay cannot take that view, I would suggest.
Well, I wonder. I remember having an argument about this years ago when I was chaplain at Imperial College. And we discovered that a very high percentage of the grants for research were coming from the Ministry of Defense. And we could see that this was a really complex question. Because for many people, if they were to say, well, I don't want to work for this particular project, because its end is immoral, well, what would then happen? What would happen to the project? What would happen to the college? What would happen to their families? And I think that it's complex. One element, I would say, would be one could actually engage, if one's family is implicated, then at least one's spouse could be involved in the taking of the decision. So one could say, well, it's our future, so what should we do? And then have to work it through. Because sometimes there are decisions one cannot simply take by oneself. I remember being a bit scandalized when St. Anthony, another great early desert father, decided that he was morally required to give up all his property. And I noticed he also gave up all his sister's property too, which struck me as being a bit too much. So I think then we have to engage people who are also going to be affected. And sometimes, and I think with each of these issues, there's no simple, abstract, pure answer from outside. And clearly I had to oversimplify a bit, otherwise I'd still be talking and you'd all go to sleep and there'd be nobody to come back tomorrow. So I think that's one element, who's going to be affected, and let them engage in the discussion. And I think also another element would be the extent to which taking what one thought was not the ideal solution, how would that actually corrupt one's moral character? Because let us imagine that you're wife, and she loves you. I'm sure she does. And she might love you partly because, surely, of your moral quality. So it could be the case that to take a decision that was destructive of your moral character would actually be also to undermine her love. Whereas if she really loves you, then she would love the person who would do what is right. Now, again, there are all sorts of nuances and discussions, and you'd have to find your way through, but I'd say that was another element in the picture. When I was young, my father was a notoriously honest person. And once he had to take a decision when his company acted in a way that he thought was improper. He took sacking a lot of people. He said, well, I will pay all their salaries personally until they find other jobs. It almost bankrupted us. But my mother said, that's the man I married. But I might well be inclined to have a little compromise here and there.
Senara l-lum billi ħankanta kanzunetta forsi jitaħuli et infakru bħalissa s-sentej mil-mewt tal-Papa Giovanni Paolo u propju dik il-ġimgħa ktibt kanzunetta dwar dan il-Papa. Jisima jivjaġġa. Tifelti jivjaġġa Battan certezza, il bissem tama, sasur hattu, il viaggia. Ben quindi mutlama, il resta al Vangelo, mi sirbra frontiri, il viaggia, maulito soldato. Sei missionario, i viaggia, solidarietà, ti al cuiccio, vitma feruz, i viaggia, al cielo al violenti, i prisca il mafra, assis ciò a i viaggia, sinagoga o moschea, tania, litaat, kulfidi. Shweya marad, i viaggia, fuq siġu tarrodi, in Bottal Helsing, moribond mit luft e viaggia. Fosodda tal mels e c'alla e dinia displahar nifstia e viaggia, e viaggia le alpi net mi e viaggia, e viaggia le alpi net mi e viaggia, e viaggia le alpi net mi e viaggia. Bilbosa dal fidi. Grazie, Hafna.